Are we a declining race? An old sailor's verdict by Walter Hunt. Chapter 3: Civil and Savage Life Compared. To rear a child is easy, but to teach morals and manners is beyond our reach. To make the foolish wise, the wicked good, that science yet was never understood. By Theognis. To what extent are we indebted to civilization for the deterioration of the race? It is my intention to point out in this chapter that although we have gained considerably in some directions by the advance of civilization, we have lost much in others. And on the whole, it is still a question whether life is more tolerable today to the ordinary man in the street, in any city in a civilized country, than it was for the savage before coming into contact with civilization, or for the ancients. The question itself I am not in a position to answer, and it is doubtful whether there are many who have had sufficient experience of savage life with a corresponding experience of the struggle for existence in any of our large towns to enable them to decide the question satisfactorily. No doubt we are indebted to the march of progress for much that we enjoy today. The meanest man in a civilized community has the advantage of protection and shelter, and although he may sometimes go hungry, he does not actually starve. The same man would most likely go under in savage life. Civilization does away with the law of the survival of the fittest in its crudest form, and the unfit are allowed to live. From the humane standpoint, this is one of the noblest results of civilization, the protection of the weak from the oppression of the strong. From a utilitarian standpoint, it might be objected that we not only protect the weak from the oppression of the strong, but we go farther and allow the unfit free scope in the propagation of their inferior species. In savage communities, they are generally more careful in this matter and do not allow any but the fit to marry. This does not apply to the more degraded savage, such as we find in some of the semi-civilized countries, but to the nobler class, such as Mr. Lewis Morgan in his Ancient Society describes as the Grand Barbarians. Few are left now, but they might have been found not many years ago in some of the Kaffir tribes, the Fijians, Iroquois Indians, etc. Of one thing we may be tolerably certain, viz., that physically we are at the present time very much their inferiors. We find more disease, more pain and suffering today in civilized communities than they could possibly have had in their lives of action and exposure. The struggle for existence is perhaps keener with us than with them. This may seem strange when we consider that the savage is often exposed to the danger of dying a violent death, either by the hand of an enemy or at the caprice of his chief or from wild beasts. But when we remember that he generally enjoys perfect health, and should he escape death by violence, lives to old age without suffering any of the inconveniences generally met with in civilized towns, the case bears a different complexion. With us, it is different, for although the more fortunate are born to a state of luxury and indulgence, the proletarian is doomed to perpetual labour, sometimes in most unwholesome surroundings, and always subject to innumerable pains and penalties unknown to the savage. The idea that pain and suffering is the unavoidable result of civilization, and that with every refinement of emotion there must be the corresponding degree of physical distress, has been held by many. The late Professor Huxley expressed himself of this opinion, quote, "There is another aspect of the cosmic process, so perfect as a mechanism, so beautiful as a work of art. Where the cosmo-poetic energy works through sentient beings, there arises among its other manifestations that which we call pain and suffering. This baleful product of evolution increases in quantity and intensity with advancing grades of animal organization until it attains its highest level in man. Further, the consummation is not reached in man, the mere animal, nor in man the whole or half savage, but only in man the member of an organized polity. And it is a necessary consequence of his attempt to live in this way, that is, under those conditions which are essential to the full development of his noblest powers." Close quote. From Evolution and Ethics. In another work, he wrote, quote, "The amount and severity of the pain have increased with every advance in the scale of evolution. As suffering came into the world, not in consequence of a fall, but of a rise in the scale of being, so every rise has brought more suffering." Close quote. From 12 Articles of Scientific Faith. If we were quite sure that this theory is correct, there would not be much encouragement for us to go on. Our efforts have been to improve the world and bring man still higher in the scale of being, but if every rise is to be accompanied by increased suffering, it would be better for us to cease our efforts. We must all deplore the fact that pain and suffering are on the increase. Perhaps civilization itself is not entirely to blame, but the mistakes in life that have not yet been rectified by civilization. I believe that with a higher conception of life than we have yet held, we shall find that pain and suffering, instead of being unavoidable, may be understood and can be used as indicators to keep us in a state of perfect health. This seems to be their purpose. If we examine briefly the marriage systems of the world, we find from the fragmentary histories handed down to us that each great nation rose to preeminence under exemplary sexual restrictions. Also, that each declined during periods of licentiousness and abandonment. Let us take first the ancient Egyptians. Dr. Birch, in speaking of the First Dynasty, says, quote, "The Egyptian woman appears always as the equal and companion of her father, brethren, and husband. She was never secluded in a harem, but sat at meals with them, had equal rights before the law, served in the priesthood, and even mounted the throne." Close quote. Rawlinson, writing of the Egyptian of the same period, says, quote, "With a prudent self-restraint, not often seen among Orientals, he limited himself to a single wife, whom he made the partner of his cares and joys, and treated with respect and affection." Close quote. From the History of Ancient Egypt. Mr. Westermark writes, quote, "All the statements we have from the ancient world seem to indicate that polygamy was an exception. In ancient Egypt, as we may infer from the numerous ancient paintings illustrative of domestic life in that country, polygamy was of rare occurrence, and Herodotus expressly affirms that it was customary for the Egyptians to marry only one wife." Close quote. What a contrast to the domestic life of 3,000 or 4,000 years later, after Egypt had survived the Old and Middle Empires, and after a military age, and was then fast declining. After the death of Ptolemy Eucrates, the Egyptian Empire, being governed either by weak monarchs or wicked monsters, quickly declined, and from that time makes no conspicuous figure in history, except in the depravity of some of its kings, in which indeed it may vie with any nation. Consanguineous marriages were very common, The Ptolemies habitually married their sisters, nieces, and cousins. Quote, Diodorus Siculus informs us that the Egyptians were not restricted to any number of wives, but that every one married as many as he chose, with the exception of the priesthood, who were by law confined to one wife. The Egyptians had concubines also, most of whom appear to have been foreign women. Close quote. From The History of Human Marriage by Westermark. Diodorus, or Diodorus, lived at an age when the glory of Egypt was departing forever, and he wrote of Egyptian habits as they appeared at the time of Caesar. Thus Egypt rose to opulence and power under exemplary matrimonial laws, and declined in an age of profligacy. Quote, as Menes in Egypt, as Phoe in China, so Cecrops in Athens is said to have first brought within restricted limits the irregular intercourse of the sexes. Close quote. Whether these kings were the founders of the institution of matrimony in their own countries or not is immaterial. It is sufficient to know that they ruled peoples who were living under exemplary matrimonial laws. Cecrops, or Cecrops, as his name is sometimes spelt, is said to have instituted laws which forbade polygamy, and the men were not allowed to marry until they were 35 years of age. Neither were they allowed to marry within certain degrees of consanguinity. This limit of age might seem unreasonable to us of the 20th century, who allow our own children to marry 20 years earlier. The statement as to the Athenian age may be disputed. It is a question difficult to verify. I have heard it stated as such, but the only work in which I could find the age mentioned is the London Encyclopedia. In the article on marriage, we read that the Spartans were not permitted to marry until they had arrived at their full strength, that their children might be strong and vigorous, and that the Athenian laws are said to have once ordered that men should not marry till 35 years of age. I take this age limit to correspond well with the condition of the people, and there seems to be no other reasonable way to account for the height of glory, opulence, and intelligence to which they attained. It was not by accident that they arrived at that condition. They were bred to it, and when they fell from their most exalted position, the cause was obvious, as I shall endeavour to point out later. Unfortunately, in all accounts of ancient civilization, the information as to the manners and customs of the people during their rise to greatness is so vague that we are left to form our own opinions about them. We only know positively of them after they have formed their systems and are either at the height of their development or are already on the downward track. The Athenians must have been physically as well as intellectually great, as witness Marathon and their rivalry with the Spartans. It is no doubt owing to the proximity of Sparta to Athens that we have some knowledge of the rise of the Spartans, for they would not be likely to record their own history, as they made a point of discouraging learning. Mitford says, quote, in England, the science of breeding horses and dogs of the most generous temper and highest bodily ability has been carried to an amazing perfection. Lacedaemon is the only country known in history where attention was ever paid to the breeding of men. Close quote. Only think of it, the noblest specimen of creation, and no attention paid to the breeding of him. More than 2,000 years have passed away since the downfall of the Spartan, and during that vast period we do not know of one civilized nation profiting to any extent from the experience of that ancient state. It is supposed by some that Lycurgus, the traditional legislator of the Spartans, gained his ideas of stirpiculture from Crete, as he had visited that island during his travels, and their methods of training were similar. We are told of the Cretans that they were celebrated throughout Greece for the education of their youth. Quote, at the age of 7, the boy was permitted to handle the crossbow. From that time, he was admitted into the society of the adults, where he continued till the age of 17. There, seated on the ground and clothed in a plain, coarse dress, he served the old men and listened in respectful silence to their advice. He was early accustomed to arms and to fatigue, and to endure excessive heat and cold, to clamber and leap among hills and precipices, and to bear manfully the blows and wounds he might receive at the gymnastic exercises or in battle. He was also taught to sing the laws, which were written in verse. When he reached the 17th year, he retired from the society of the adults and became a member of that of the young men. Here his education was still carried on. He exercised himself in hunting, wrestling, and fighting with his companions. When the youth had finished their exercises and attained the legal age, they became members of the class of adults, were permitted to vote in the national assemblies, and were permitted to stand as candidates for any public office. They were then obliged to marry, but did not take home their wives till they were capable of managing their domestic concerns. Under these wise regulations, the Republic rose to glory, opulence, and power, and was honoured with the panegyrics of the most celebrated philosophers of Greece. Since the conquest of Crete by the Romans, the Cretans have no longer formed a separate nation, nor made any figure among the states and kingdoms of the world. Their noble and ingenious manners, their arts and sciences, their valour and their virtues are no more. Close quote. The separation of the sexes seems to have been an important point in the training of youth in Greece, as well as the limit of age for marriage. The Spartans also were not allowed to take their wives home until some time after marriage. Mitford tells us that Lycurgus made it criminal for young men to be seen in the company of women, even after they were married. When first married, the Spartan would have to continue his exercises with the young men by day and sleep in the common dormitory by night. While these rules were observed, both Spartan and Cretan flourished, and their abandonment resulted in the downfall of each. Physical decline must have been well advanced with the Athenians at the time of Plato, for he seems to have recognised that there was something wanting in their system of intercourse. The old matrimonial system may have been abandoned, for in his Republic he thus represents Socrates as conversing on the subject. Socrates, and how can marriages be made beneficial? That is a question I put to you, because I see in your house dogs for hunting, and of the nobler sort of birds, not a few. Now I beseech you to tell me, have you ever attended to their pairing and breeding? Answer, exactly. Socrates, why, in the first place, although they are all of a good sort, are not some better than others? Answer, true. Socrates, and do you breed from them all indifferently, or do you care to breed from the best only? Answer, from the best. Socrates, and do you take the oldest or the youngest, or only those of ripe age? Answer, I choose only those of ripe age. Socrates, and if care were not taken in the breeding, your dogs and birds would greatly deteriorate? Answer, certainly. Socrates, and the same of the horses and of animals in general? Answer, undoubtedly. Socrates, good heavens, my dear friend, what consummate skill would our rulers need if the same principle holds of the human species? Answer, certainly the same principle holds good, but why does this involve any particular skill? Socrates, the best of either sex should be united as often and the inferior as seldom as possible, and they should rear the offspring of the one sort of union, but not of the other, if the stock is to be maintained. This is not likely to meet the views of our present-day moralists, yet there is a good deal more humanity in it than there is in our system of indiscriminate reproduction. Wealth seems to be the most important factor in the institution of matrimony today. No matter what the contracting parties may be, physically or mentally, money is the great consideration. Lunatics, epileptics, consumptives, drunkards and criminals, deaf and dumb, halt or blind, all are eligible, so long as there is a sufficient amount of money forthcoming, and in many cases even when there is none. But there is no need for us to resort to infanticide to get out of our difficulties. What we do today, we do in ignorance. We allow the immature and the unfit to propagate their inferior species, because we have never taken the trouble to consider the matter. But when we come to consider seriously the claims of our children and our children's children, we must recognise the injustice of our proceedings and take steps to discourage improper unions. The same cause of deterioration is to be traced in the history of all nations. All authors are agreed that China flourished under the exemplary laws said to have been instituted by Fowey at a very remote age. One of the greatest drawbacks was the recognition of polygamy and concubinage. A very ancient stanza attributed to the great Yu, supposed founder of the Kya, the first of the three most ancient dynasties, indicates that there was a certain amount of philosophy in vogue at the time. Quote, "Within to be addicted to effeminate pleasures, without to the sports of the field, to be fond of wine, of music, or of palaces elegantly adorned, to delight in any of these, will be doubtless inevitable ruin." Close quote. Anyone who knows the China of today can, with a very little penetration, recognise the cause of their misery in the physical deterioration brought about by their injudicious connections. Early marriages, coupled with the effects of unnatural vices, have left their impressions. Instances have been known in some provinces of China where six and even seven generations have been represented at the same time in the one family. Parents view with horror the possibility of their children growing up without getting married. They therefore arrange their betrothals while they are yet infants, and the children consider themselves in duty bound to act accordingly. Dr. Gray says, quote, "Almost all Chinese, robust or infirm, well-formed or deformed, are called upon by their parents to marry as soon as they have attained the age of puberty. Were a grown-up son or daughter to die unmarried, their parents would regard it as most deplorable." Close quote. From China by J.H. Gray. Surely it is not to be wondered at that a race should decline under such a systematic demoralizing influence. Quote, "It is now known that some animals are capable of reproduction at a very early age, before they have acquired their perfect characters, and if this power becomes thoroughly well developed in a species, it seems probable that the adult stage of development would sooner or later be lost, and in this case, especially if the larva differed much from the mature form, the character of the species would be greatly changed and degraded." Close quote. From The Origin of Species by Darwin. I think we may accept this view of Darwin as carrying some weight, even with the human species, and when we consider that the smaller and weaker races of mankind are generally those who marry early in life, we may place some confidence in the theory. The Malays, Vedas and Dhammanese, Siamese, Javanese, etc., all marry between the ages of 11 and 17, and are all of diminutive stature. On the other hand, we find among savage races, where from various reasons marriage is delayed until later in life, the men are, as a rule, robust and strong. Among the Zulus, for instance, quote, young men who are without cattle have often to wait many years before getting married, close quotes, by Westermark. Among the Bechuanas, the youth is not allowed to take a wife until he has killed a rhinoceros, from Livingstone, so that they are not likely to marry very early. Among the wild Indians of British Guiana, before a man is allowed to choose a wife, he must prove that he can do a man's work. In many of the Papuan tribes, the bridegroom was compelled to cultivate a certain amount of land for the father of his bride before he could have her. And among the Fijians, the unfit were not allowed to marry at all. These people were all of quite superior physique prior to their contact with us, but the last 20 or 30 years has made a vast difference in the physical condition of many of them. So far, the benefits of civilization have not compensated the savage for the degradation resulting from this introduction to the vicious habits of civilized peoples. Unfortunately, those who first come in contact with savage tribes are seldom the best possible persons to introduce higher ideals of life to them. And there are very few, if any, countries where the natives have really benefited by contact with our civilization. The result of European influence on the natives of the Pacific Islands offers us a striking example of the cause of physical decline. One of the most striking characteristics of the natives in former times was the perfect health which seemed their constant possession. Captain Cook tells us of the natives of the Otaheite, discovered in 1767 by Captain Wallace, and visited afterwards by M. Bougainville. Quote, the islanders, who inhabit huts exposed to all the winds, and hardly covering the earth, which serves them for a bed, with a layer of leaves, are remarkably healthy and vigorous, and live to old age, without enduring any of its infirmities. Their senses are acute, and they retain their beautiful teeth to the last. Close quote. The first to come under the baneful influence of the foreigner were the first to suffer, and a little more than 20 years later, when Captain Vancouver visited the island, he found that the personal attractions of the women did not correspond with the accounts of former navigators. Quote, according to the natives, they had fallen off in their looks, which they attributed to their indiscriminate commerce with Europeans and to the loathsome diseases they had received from their visitors. Close quote. The Sandwich Islands were discovered by Cook in the year 1778. 40 years later, the native deterioration was thus commented upon in the London Encyclopedia. Quote, the face of things since the time of Cook has been completely changed. The cloak of vermil-tinctured feathers, once worn by the chieftains, has been exchanged for a guise of European fashion, and the plumy sceptre or carheli, which was wont to precede persons of distinction, is now displaced by some foreign badge of rank and office. Nor has the outward garb alone undergone a great change since that period, if we may judge of the present generation, by comparing them with a few old men who are the survivors of the last. For there has been a great falling off in mental activity and manly fortitude. An observer discovers a certain nobility of disposition, indicated by the carriage of the elder race, and a certain frankness of humour, of which he cannot discern the slightest symptom in their drowsy-headed offspring, who crowd the courts and dwellings of the chiefs. In the room of engaging in those sports and gymnastic exercises which were once the favourite amusements of his forefathers, a native betakes himself to his mat and solaces his cares by reciting a psalm or portion of sacred scripture which the industrious missionary has clothed in the dialect of his willing convert. In order to train and bring under subjection the humours of the younger people, an absolute authority over them seems necessary. For where diet, lodging and climate tend to foster the concupiscible part of our nature and the restraints of legal enactments, custom and example are scarcely felt. The cordial draught, mingled by cirque for the unwary, becomes far more tasteful, and its draught attended with less remorse than in societies where legislation and the judgment of civil courts provide pains and penalties for transgressors. The counterpart of the sirens, fabled in ancient story, who have been deemed by some to exist only in the imagination of poets, may be found at Oahu. He who was so void of understanding as to listen to the pleasing sorcery of their enticements, never after felt any longings after the blandishments of home, nor the fond caresses of his wife and children. And it is not uncommon thing to witness a youth of respectable parentage and hopeful parts allured on his first visit to Oahu into the vortex of sensual delights, and after reeling a few years in dizzy dissipation, snatched away by a fit of apoplexy, unless he be removed from inevitable ruin by some forceful interposition. Close quotes. This wantonness, so conspicuous among the women of the Sandwich Islands, and which has resulted in their ruin, was but the result of European influence in the first place. Quote, when visiting the Sandwich Islands with Cook, Vancouver saw little or no appearance of wantonness among the women. But when he visited them some years afterwards, it was very conspicuous, more so than among the worst of the Tahitians, and he ascribes this change in their habits to their intercourse with foreigners. Close quote. By Westermark. This baneful influence of European vices on native races is also witnessed among the Aborigines of Australia. Quote, the females are, many if not most of them, prostitutes from childhood, and the men not only connive at but offer their wives for the worst of purposes. It is lamentable that the iniquitous example set to the Aboriginal inhabitants has, in all countries occupied by the English, been attended by the like evil result, the introduction of European vices and fatal disease. Close quote. From the Aborigines of Victoria by R. Brough Smythe, Volume 2. The Aborigines of Tasmania suffered in a similar manner from the same causes, and they have now for some years been totally extinct. The Maoris of New Zealand, a splendid race, have also deteriorated greatly. This also is traceable to the same causes. If these people retain any recollection of their former condition, how they must hate the sight of a white man. Among almost all South Sea Islanders, chastity was considered as a necessary virtue with the young women, and in some cases, even after their contact with foreigners, they were reserved among themselves. Westermark says, quote, in Samoa, the girls were allowed to cohabit with foreigners, but not with their own countrymen, and the chastity of the chief's daughters was the pride of the tribe. In Fiji, great continence prevailed. They had a system peculiarly their own, a description of which I reserve for another chapter. Although in many of these places the natives wear very scant covering, New Britain was the only place I ever visited, where the people of both sexes went entirely nude. This condition, shocking as it may appear to us, seemed quite natural to them. They did not appear to be in any way disconcerted before strangers, and were as modest in their behaviour as any other people I know. The party of five of us went on an expedition to a lake in the interior to shoot cassowaries. I saw nothing indecent on the part of the natives the whole time we were on shore. At night we would find one of the most commodious huts prepared for us in the villages that we passed through, and it was remarkable to find that as soon as it began to get dark, the women withdrew from the parts of the villages in which the men slept to huts of their own. The separation of the sexes at night appears to be a relic of an old custom of the Papuans, which has gradually been abandoned on coming into contact with European ideas. There are numerous savage and barbarous peoples among whom sexual intercourse out of wedlock is of rare occurrence, and unchastity on the part of the woman being looked upon as a disgrace and a crime. Close quotes, Westermark. Mr. Winwood Reed tells us of the equatorial savages of Africa. Quote, "A girl who disgraces her family by wantonness is banished from her clan, and in case of seduction, the man is severely flogged. Theft is also punishable by flogging, and adultery by the payment of a large sum, in default of which death or slavery is at the option of the husband." Close quote. From Savage Africa. The late Reverend J. Shorter tells us that the Kaffir laws also were very strict for these crimes. Adultery, fine or death. Rape, fine or death. And murder, fine or death. Winwood Reed wrote of the moral bearing of the people thusly, quote, "For my part, I can say that during the whole time which I passed in Africa, I never saw so much as one indecent gesture pass between a man and a woman." Close quote. Another writer, in describing the Kaffirs of South Africa, writes, quote, "A Kaffir woman is chaste and extremely modest." Close quotes. From Travels in Southern Africa by J. Barrow, Volume 1. In treating of these savage races, I have endeavoured to point out three things. First, that where it is customary to delay marriage until a more advanced age, we find the people enjoying better health and finer physique than where they marry at a very early age. Second, that in many cases, the savages are really more chaste than the general run of people in civilised countries, and that as a rule, they enjoy perfect health. Third, that they almost invariably deteriorate as soon as they begin to adopt civilized customs, and in some cases whole races die out. This, in a manner, may explain how pain and suffering have increased with every advance in the scale of evolution. And later on, I hope to show more definitively, that is, decidedly, by our own fault, that these evils have increased. End of chapter 3.